This is Cars and Crafts, hosted by Linda and David.
That's us.
On KPBF 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM every Sunday at 2 p.m. The power
of people. All right, we are with special guests today. It's David and Linda. Say hi, Linda.
Hi, Linda.
And Tracy. Say hi, Tracy.
Hi.
We also have Josh and Clint in the studio today.
Hi, Josh.
Friends of mine.
Howdy.
Hi.
So, Formula One. Monza took place most recently when we're recording this. Big, shocking result.
It was exciting. It was a great race. I was on the edge of my seat halfway through the end of the race. It was pretty cool.
What did you like most about it?
I got to see crashes, and I got to see the rest of the pack race. I didn't have to focus on Hamilton and Verstappen the entire time. I got to see everybody else tooling around the racetrack, vying for the win. I mean, it was cool.
It was cool. The unfortunate crash between Verstappen and Hamilton. We've seen some of that already this season. I think we're going to see more of that.
Definitely, because neither one of them is going to relent. Both of them wants to win the championship. Both of them are fighting, and both of them are not guys that are going to give in. So they're just going to push, and they're going to keep taking each other out. That's We're looking back at like the great battles of the past of
Senna and Prost.
Yeah.
Schumacher and Hakkinen. And
there farther was back, Lauda and Hunt. I mean, it's.
Yeah, exactly. This is what great champions do.
Yeah. This is the type of battle we've been waiting in F1 for since Hamilton signed with Mercedes.
Yeah. since Vettel at Red Bull. I don't know how far back we have to go to find a good duel like this. Raikkonen winning for Ferrari.
I was going
to
say, the last good duel we had was Rosberg and Hamilton duking each other out on the same team.
Yeah, Rosberg did an amazing job. That was to come from number two and win that championship. Did you see the pass that Verstappen tried to make in the chicane, and did you have an opinion about it
just
when he bumped with Hamilton?
He bumped, and I know he got the place penalty, but it was a racing incident. They were both going in. Only one car was going to fit there, and neither one was going to let go, and it was a racing incident. So,
and it was really bizarre. They were in that same point in the track at the same time because Verstappen had that 10-second pit stop. Which,
it was 11.
Thank you, 11 second. Which put him in an awkward place on the track. And then when Hamilton came out, Verstappen just needed to attack and take that position if he was going to. So.
Well, and Hamilton had a long pit stop as well, didn't he?
I don't recall that. You could be right.
It was over four.
It was over 4 seconds.
Yeah.
He had a long pit stop.
They both had long stops.
Verstappen had a glacial pit stop.
So if they both would have had their standard, that probably wouldn't even happen, right?
Yeah. And I think you had two guys that were already heated up.
Oh, of course.
Waiting for those long pit stops.
When you have two athletes of any type.
Yeah.
They're going to be heated anyway, whether it's F1 or swimming. I mean, just saying. it was cool. For me, it was cool to see. So I'm new to the whole F1 thing. I really enjoy watching them. So it was really neat. As soon as I saw that happen, I literally stood up out of my chair, like excited about the whole thing. I got to see it. And then I learned about the halo thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, what is that all about? That's new or something?
The last couple of years, I don't remember exactly when they brought it in, but it's been a couple of years now.
So that saved Hamilton.
It saved Hamilton and more importantly, last year, it was just last year, right, when Grosjean pierced a guardrail. You guys haven't seen that crash. Mm-hmm. We should have. Maybe we'll talk about it in the future. But it was an awkward part of the track. I forget what track it was. Abu Dhabi, I think. But went through an old-style metal guardrail. The car went right through it like an arrow, like a bullet. And if he didn't have the halo, it would have taken his head right off.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
The car broke in half, burst into flames. And on camera, you couldn't see anything except this smoke and flames. The emergency people got there. The car's burning like crazy. You can't see anything. He's still in it.
Oh.
15 seconds, 20 seconds later, he jumps out of the flames.
Okay.
He had burns on his hands minorly.
And
that was it.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And now he's in IndyCar and doing extremely well. He finished third over the weekend at Laguna Seca. So amazing. So IndyCar has their own version. Formula One monkeyed around with different.
I think they all started monkeying around with different ideas. And everybody complained about how awful it looked. And aesthetically, it doesn't look that great, but it keeps the drivers alive. I mean,
Exactly.
That's the center metal pillar arrangement.
Yeah, that turns it into more of a closed cockpit instead of an open cockpit car. Yeah.
Okay.
IndyCar has more of a fighter jet style shield situation than Formula One went with the halo. Do you remember when Massa got hit by the spring?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a freak accident.
Yeah.
And he was lucky to live through that, quite frankly. Went on to race even further.
That wasn't his almost championship year, was it?
I think it was, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're glossing over. Probably the biggest news of Monza was
Danny Ricciardo's
back.
That was pretty sweet.
That was amazing.
He wasn't excited at all.
So Ricciardo's been struggling in the McLaren. We've talked about this before. The car is a little awkward to drive, and he's come from a different style of car, different engine, different power plant, different power delivery, different braking system. So the McLaren is entirely different. So he's he's had a struggle adapting, which is understandable until you look at the results of his teammate, and you always measure yourself directly against your teammate in the same car. Lando Norris has just been absolutely killing it. Until two races ago, he was the only driver to finish in the points every single race this year.
Okay.
But Ricardo, with the sprint format, I think was helpful to him.
Okay, wait. So for those of us who are new and making faces, what does the sprint format, what does that really mean? Because I know that there's like...
The sprint format is, it's a new thing. Formula One's trying this year. They're doing it, trying it at 3-1s. Normally you have your qualifying.
Right.
Fastest lap through the various sessions, start on pole. Well, this one you do qualifying and then you start on the sprint qualifying. Don't call it a sprint race. The FIA will blow up.
Right.
But it's about a 15 minute or 18 lap-ish race somewhere in there. Start off, then however you finish in that, that's where you start in the race.
That pole
yeah.
position.
Yeah, that establishes qualifying.
So yep. that takes over the Q1, 2, and 3, or is that just...
Well, you still have Q1, 2, and Q3 to set up where you start in the sprint qualifying.
Okay.
And then you do that race. It mixes things up a little bit. It's
what's the point?
The idea is to try to mix it up so that it's not just Mercedes always being on pole because they run down the fastest laps.
Right.
It's to mix things up, trying to make it more exciting, make the actual race more exciting.
Well, the race was exciting
and give an actual, because a sprint, it looks like a race. So you actually, now you have a race on Saturday and not just qualify.
Okay.
Because qualifying is just cars going around where a race is actually a race. So Ricardo did well in that, which helped him start in the front.
He started in P2.
Correct.
Ricardo did?
Yeah. Okay. And then he got
past Verstappen in the first corner. Yeah,
he got the better start on Verstappen, and that just
and then he stayed there the whole time,
yeah.
right?
He did, yeah. And partly that was
and
because
all the drama stayed behind him.
That's right. Partly that's because the pole position at Monza was off the racing line. Ricardo being in P2 actually had the inside line going into the corner, so that was a little odd thing from Monza. And also was on the cleaner part of the track, so I think those two things helped Ricardo get past Verstappen, and then he was able to stay there.
And he stayed there, and then it was towards the end of the race, or was it the sprint? I don't remember it. I think it was the race that Norris was asking, am I going around? Am I staying behind? It seemed a little...
Norris wanted to fight.
He team tension.
To take it. Yeah. And basically they came out, team orders, you're not going to pass.
Right.
That's not...
I think it was fair.
We want the 1-2. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But this is the problem with being... I'm sorry. This is the problem with being an allegedly number two driver is that you're supposed to give way to the number one driver. And this has been... over time, over history, fraught with stories of number two drivers that don't want to give up to number one. Most famously, recently, was Mark Webber and Sebastian Vettel, where they actually gave team orders for Vettel to move over, and he just refused to do it. Wow. And he wound up winning, and there was a code for it that they had in the team. It was the headlines for a long time. So the rest of the finishes, Bottas finished third because Hamilton and Verstappen got taken out. Then Leclerc and the Ferrari came in fourth. We had Perez and the other Red Bull do fifth. Sainz and the other Ferrari in sixth. Lance Stroll, seventh. Alonso, eighth. George Russell, ninth. Points paying again. Ocon in 10th, and then on down the list.
But I think, didn't Bottas take third because Perez got a penalty? Wasn't he supposed to take third, and then he took a penalty and he got pushed?
Yeah,
and then...
Perez went off the track, didn't re-enter right. He gained a position. He didn't give it right back, so they...
Exceeded track limits, 5-second penalty, and
so then he lost his third place, which is how Valtteri Bottas...
Yeah, and exactly.
It feels like Bottas just kind of backed off once they found out there was the 5-second penalty, so they felt
they couldn't press
to pass the first two, so...
Colin, have you spent any time watching Formula One this year, or results, or ESPN, or anything?
I have not.
Okay.
I apologize.
No, it's okay. Tracy, no?
She's shaking her head.
Right.
You know, this is radio. People can't see you. Visit Montservino Urban Winery at 4655 Town Center Drive, Suite 130 near Platt and Murray, and spend time,
like we did,
with Matt and Katie in their cozy tasting room sampling beautifully made wines
and handcrafted Boxing Brothers hard cider.
Come find your favorite.
I'm here with Josh and Clint. We're going to talk about significant vintage rally cars from back
Josh
in the day.
Clint.
Hi, Linda, Tracy. Tracy's here.
Hello.
Josh, you like to argue about the most significant time period in rally or the most important time period in rally, right?
Yeah,
most people would think most people would think is the famous Group B cars.
The Group B last made the biggest impression on everyone just because it was so extreme and over the top and amazing leap forwards in technology and speeds and
we saw the
heroic
first
drivers and
yeah, exactly. We saw the first instance of all-wheel drive cars in Group B.
Yeah.
the Audi
Quattro coming in and just flipping the whole rally world on its head.
I read this morning, doing a little bit of research, because that's what we do here at Cars and Crafts. We actually try to be informed.
We try. Yeah. We really do try.
They did basically an exhibition of the Audi when they were considering allowing four-wheel drive cars. And most of the manufacturers were against it because it adds a lot of weight and complexity, and they didn't think that the time gained would be worth it. So they did an exhibition with the Audi.
The Audi entered the rally just as an exhibition, so it didn't get an official place or anything, and mopped the floor with everything.
30 minutes faster over the course of the rally.
Yeah.
Usually it measures in 2 or 3 seconds. Yeah, over the course of a weekend.
Real big grin might be 5 minutes.
And yeah. 30 minutes faster. So that changed the whole course of rally. We can talk about the cars that were significant in Group B, and we can talk more about Group B, but your argument is you think Group A was even more important than Group B or more significant.
Yeah.
So
Group A is even more significant than Group B because it gave us so many cars that as enthusiasts we love that we can actually get, maybe not necessarily always in this country until they're 25 years old, but you get things like Lancia Delta Integrale, bring in the Toyota Celica GT4/Alltrack that they branded it in this country. You have the original Legacy Turbo, which then got developed
Subaru.
And became the Impreza Turbo, WRX, STI. Mitsubishi came in with the Gallant Turbo, which became, or the Gallant, was it the VR4?
Lancer. Yeah.
And then became the Lancer and the Evo.
Right.
And, you know, 10 generations of Evo that were just with hundreds of special editions in between that were just incremental improvements to make the rally cars better and make the road cars more fun. And you had many more entrants because the price point of getting into rally is still really high at the top level. You could have so many more entrants because it did bring that down from the Group B development. You had a lot more cars. You had a lot more interesting. You had a lot of great drivers that came out of there. But mostly it comes down to just how great the cars were. And
available to the general public.
Yeah, exactly. It's something you could go
into the showroom and get one.
Yeah,
exactly.
I saw it on Sunday and on Monday, I'm going to go buy one.
And Group B was not supposed to be production based. I mean, you had to homologate a certain number of cars, but it's like 200 cars, no big deal. And they would, like Audi with their Quattro.
Across town.
That's right. Exactly. Those stories. But Audi would do things like they'd show 200 cars they sold to the public, but the race cars actually had composite panels and, you know, there wasn't the same car.
Yeah.
If you're not cheating, you're not trying, right? You guys are big Subaru fans, both of you. What makes the Subaru so good? What made the Impreza so good? And then leading up to today, what makes the WRX so good?
So what made the Impreza so good for rally and as a road car, it was quick, it was reliable. Those were the two big things. It go fast and it could finish the rally. And then you add on great drivers like
Burns,
Colin McRae, Richard Burns, and you have the birth of a legend. And then Subarus, you could turn around and buy one for an Impreza Turbo in the UK and European markets for, you know, the price of a
12,000 pounds.
Yeah, for the price of a, you know, Ford sedan, typical Ford sedan. And at that time, country road, it could keep up with any Ferrari.
So Subaru runs primarily a flat four, similar to a Volkswagen engine, except it's not air-cooled, it's water-cooled. And it's placed over the front wheels and still it's a four-wheel drive car. You talk about reliability. Is it that power plant that helps it become so reliable? And if so, why?
So, well, the power plant, I mean, the power plant is solid and reliable unless you start doing just stupid things to it in the aftermarket.
Like 40 pounds of boost. That kind
of
stuff.
Exactly. It's not a Mack truck engine. You can't put that much boost in. Mm-hmm. But you can, it's reliable and it's low center gravity because it's flat. It keeps everything down low. And because it's so short, being a flat four or a boxer four, it's so short, it don't have that huge overhang like every Audi engine that has all its weight in front of the front axle. It just has a good chunk of weight in front of the front axle. So that helped with handling too. And it was, you know, it's your kind of typical Japanese build quality where just to make everything work, it wasn't cutting edge. It wasn't 20 valve engines or 5 valves per cylinder. It wasn't all those crazy things. It was just a continually developed engine that worked.
And I think the structure of the opposing four like that, the boxer engine, develops a lot of torque.
Yes.
Right off the line versus, you know, 4-cylinder that's upright, which is more, we got to spool it up. So that probably helps.
Yeah. Subaru claimed that not having to fight gravity did actually help with wear and tear too, because you're not literally pushing pistons up. They're going sideways.
How interesting.
Yeah. That was in some of the training materials when we used to shell for them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nicely done. Clint, you're on the Jones for the, or you've been looking forward to, let me phrase it that way. You've been looking forward to the new 2020, 2021, whatever it is, 2022, I don't even know.
22.
WRX, right? They recently showed pictures of it, some specs. What can you tell us about the upcoming WRX and why you like it and why it's so good?
They stuck the landing so well that I ordered a 21 immediately before the 22. That's sarcasm.
Okay.
This is radio. Right? You can't radio sarcasm.
See his sarcastic face.
Okay.
Yeah. They put in a larger engine, 2.4 liter, which came over from other vehicles that they've already turbocharged it in, the Legacy and the Ascent. So everyone was like, bigger displacement. This thing's going to break 300 in the Rex. It's going to be 400 in the STI. 3 more horsepower for the 2022 model year. There is an industry rumor that has more to do with EPA regulations and that they're waiting for the electric car to add add to the lineup, and then they can bump the power, but that could be years away before that happens. So they legitimately landed like on their face.
So wait, I have a question.
Please.
This is the girl asking.
You go, girls.
Yes.
WRX, and you said electric. Does that mean that they're coming out with a hybrid? Or
no.
What are you saying?
So Subaru's coming out with a pure electric car, the Solterra. And once that gets added to the lineup, that brings the overall model lineup EPA numbers up.
CAFE standard.
Yes. And so that the theory is that will allow them the breathing room to develop more horsepower and bring the mileage down on the bigger power plant engine.
But okay. So CAFE generally is that across all the models that you sell, you have to hit an average mile per gallon. For every Cadillac Escalade that they sell, they have to sell some four-cylinder on the other end to try to balance that out, right? Okay. Is it, Josh, do you know if CAFE takes into account the number of units that you sell, or is every vehicle?
I believe it's balanced out by the number of unit.
Okay.
General Motors, who has, you know, sells a million cars a year, is going to have different. One vehicle gas guzzler is going to affect it differently than Subaru that sells 600,000
right.
in a good year.
And I did read in my blurbs that I saw on the new WRX that it was supposed to be over 400 horsepower for the STI.
Yeah, that, and they haven't announced anything for the STI yet, so they could be holding more in reserve to push people that way. Don't know yet because we expected floodgates and we got a little bit of a trickle. They didn't even announce the full colors. They didn't announce, you know, details of the trim levels. And it was supposed to get announced at the auto show. It got canceled because of COVID.
Right.
So then they went to a digital launch. And it, like I said, it was kind of a weird.
But they brilliantly did on a Friday morning. So nobody's reading about it at work the next day.
Right. Yeah. Should do those on Monday.
So.
Well, that's too bad.
And then they've
been doing great and you've been looking forward to it.
The engine that seems to be a lackluster advance, even despite an extra 400 cc's of displacement, the design is just
not
confusing.
There.
Yeah. One publication read online described it as pulling off the unique trick of being both bland and fussy at the same time.
Wow. That's brutal.
Yeah, the back has harsh. An outgrowth where a bumper would normally be, more importantly, a painted bumper. They went with...
Is that for twerking?
come on now.
No, it's so you can rest your ramen cup while you vape. But... And as Josh and I can tell you, anything that's not painted is just that much more prone to showing scuffs and stuff. These black panels that you see, the cladding on all these SUV-type vehicles, they added that all the way around the base of the car. So everyone said it looks like a Crosstrek to start. And then the whole back bumper is just this black plastic.
Sounds fabulous.
And they're trying to mold in this diffuser and vents, but none of it's real. It's just molded black plastic cladding in it.
I understand the lower cladding from a production perspective because it's cheap to make and it's easy, and it's easy to repair when people, you know, hit curbs and hit each other and all that kind of stuff. So I understand why they do it. But
when everybody describes it as either a Crosstrek or a Pontiac Aztek, you know things have gone.
You found the sweet spot. Yes. Back to rally. Tracy, you learned a little bit about rally over the past week.
Yes.
What comes to mind when we talk about rally?
I know one of the groups was canceled now because of the Henry guy dying.
Yeah, Henry Tovenin. in a Lancia?
I thought it was a Peugeot.
One of those. but anyway, yeah. And it was a
It was a European car.
It was a European car. Right. Maybe French even. It was a part of the course where there was no cameras or spectators. That was tragic.
Passenger two passed away.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah, instantly. Yeah, there is some, I've seen some video of it. There is a piece of video of the car leaving the course and hitting a tree and then bouncing into the bottom of the valley. But so yeah, that did kill Group B. Did you see pictures, the Group B cars parting the crowds? This to me is the craziest thing about
that's
Group
the,
B.
Yeah, that's the most enduring image.
Did you guys see any?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I was going to dig one out for you.
But fans, it's better in motion too. Fans literally would stand on the course and just wait to see the car coming, leaning out, standing, and then they would just move as the car was coming at 90 miles an hour.
How did they not get
gravel.
Smacked upside
seconds?
They did get smacked around.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Scary.
Or like Moses.
They'd wait
forward
at the bottom of a big jump, which was it the Rally Argentina that has the famous jump? Iconic pictures of an Audi Quattro flying over. I mean, we're getting
seriously?
Multiple.
Oh my goodness.
Air. Yeah. And people are waiting at the bottom of it and they just.
At the last second.
Yep. And they've been doing this like for years.
40,
this is just how you do
years.
It.
Yeah, they pretty much nipped that all in the bud.
I would hope so.
Probably in the 70s started getting more and more intense, and then by the height of the Group B era, it was just.
Okay.
I can't believe it ever happened in the first place.
Yeah,
I don't understand. It was around the world.
But they do that the hill climb. Don't they do that on the hill climb? Like they just kind of stand on the side.
Yeah.
Back in the day, didn't they do that? Just
back in the day, kind of, but no. I mean, that's never been.
I don't know.
I don't think they let you as close.
I've made the comment before that I think the Pikes Peak hill climb is one of the greatest challenges in motor racing. And I'm prejudiced because it made a huge impression on me when I was a kid. I grew up in the region and was up on the mountain quite a bit. But the in-camera, the in-car shots from rally racing, you can go as far back as you want to, completely, absolutely floors me, knocks me out. And as a kid, we grew up driving way too fast on dirt roads, but they were cheap, slow cars. So we throw them off the road. bang the panels out, put them back in the road.
But
no, you put it in the little ditch culver on the side.
Exactly.
You have someone pull you out.
But the in-car shots of rally racing.
Going back to Pikes Peak, it did break my heart when they paved the upper half of it. Rally to me is, and I know it's kind of a special stage and it's kind of its own thing. Rally is dirt and sliding, and it did make me
snow
very sad.
And ice
exactly. When they paved the top of, and I'm sure there was a lot of reasons, but the times then just got bonkers. Now it's all electric cars winning everything, which is fine. That's innovation, but Rally is gravel being spit out.
There are tarmac stages in World Rally Championship. They do some of that. So you do have to have a car that's capable of doing both.
I bet with the electric cars, they're just going to be going even faster because of how light they are, right? Isn't that what you would contribute it to, is being so light?
Electric cars are actually heavier.
It's the battery packs weigh so much.
But you get faster acceleration. There is like no dead zone. It's 100% of your power is available at zero RPM.
Yeah.
And are they racing with people that don't have the electric cars against each other, or is it separate classes?
Right now they have electric races, but it's solely electric cars. E-Rally, E-Formula,
Formula E racing. Yeah,
exactly.
Was it Extreme E?
Rallycross, there's different. But no, they don't imagine running. There's no current conversation about running electric cars with gas cars in World Rally or really any motorsports. Quite a bit different.
Plus the batteries drain so fast at the high speeds that they can't do the same. So Formula E is how many less laps? I mean, it's like, 20 laps tops or something?
And they used to run, every driver had two cars. So when you made a pit stop, you didn't just refuel, you changed cars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because we're going to do electric vehicles in another segment, but that's the limiting thing with electric vehicles is the batteries, far behind the battery technology.
Weight, range, and what you can get out of for what you're carrying.
When you talk about the weight of electric vehicles, Tracy, the other thing about the batteries, they're very heavy and they put them low in the bottom of the car. So the car has a gravity benefit that you don't get with a gas car. Exactly. Traction and torque. Exactly.
The last one. 4 or 5 years on Pikes Peak, the fastest time has been an electric on the hill climb.
Yeah, since the, I think even a little before the Volkswagen one, they had some electric.
Loeb in a Peugeot, right?
Yeah.
He absolutely killed it. The WRC winners, going back in 87, it was Lancia. Lancia just killed it right out of the box. Yeah. Lancia won 3 years in a row, 87, 88, and 89. Then Toyota, the Toyota Celica GT4, an easily forgotten car, took it with Carlos Sainz, a not easily forgotten man, whose son is in Formula One. We talked about him earlier. 91 was a Lancia again. 92 was Saints and the Celica again. 93 was the Celica again. 94 was the Celica again.
Still a gorgeous car, by the way.
You like it?
Oh, I love the GT4.
Yeah?
I love those four headlights. I just, a less over-the-top Supra. I still love the design of that car.
Unfortunately for me, it hasn't aged well because every car now and has since the Celica GT4 looks like the Celica GT4. That kind of super smooth, I call it soap bar school of styling. Think of the 97 Ford Taurus, the Camry in that time period. Now they're starting to put wings and stuff on them. But unfortunately for me, the design hasn't aged well, like a lot of these other cars.
The Celica GT4 is like in the homologation special realm. It's kind of forgotten. I mean, there's some people that know about it and like them, but it doesn't receive the same attention that the Subaru does, the Evo does, the Lancia does. And
I think it was
a dominant car.
Yeah.
It was that. And I think it was that Toyota never really
promoted it, marketed it.
Yeah.
Like Subaru, the opposite of Subaru, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Subaru basically built their whole
brand
around the rally car and people carrying their dogs to the mountains.
like Clint told me the other day, if he does order or was going to order a 2022 WRX, he wanted it WRX blue with the gold wheels, which shows you the strength of the Subaru marketing program behind that car.
Right. Following on the Toyotas, which is a really good one. It's nice. The green, the red, the white.
Yeah.
Looks good. It's underrated. And then they got busted for one of the best cheating scandals in rally history.
Oh, tell us about that, Josh.
I can't recall which season it was right now, but they had air restrictors to limit the horsepower in Group A. So, you have basically just a small little...
Was it a balance of performance thing? Like every car, different size restrictor, or all the cars had the same size restrictor?
I think they all had the same size restrictor. Don't hold me to that, but...
It makes sense.
The story, everybody had the same restrictor, 38 millimeter or 42 or whatever. And engineers came up with the just ingenious system to get around it. And basically, where the restrictor was in the air intake, they made a device that was around the restrictor, which would basically push the restrictor out and let air go around the restrictor. So it wasn't actually opening the restrictor itself larger, just let lots of air go around the restrictor when they needed it.
Brilliant.
It would close up. And then when the inspectors look at it, oh yeah, see, there's a restrictor. It looks fine. It looks great. And it was the too much greed that got them. I mean, they were just setting times.
If you're not cheating, you're not trying.
Oh yeah. That's one of the best parts that's what motorsports, you find the loopholes, you find the ways you try to get around it and stuff and get around as long as you can until someone smacks you on the wrist or changes the rules.
I'll make a short digression. Smokey Unick was the most famous for doing that back in the 60s.
And so was that the NASCAR mechanic?
Yeah, crew chief. Yeah, car owner. So the best story about him is that this is back when NASCAR used to actually take production cars and run them in races. So Smokey Unick built a 7A scale 1967 Chevelle. And so this is before templates, right? So you park it next to one, you say, well, I don't know, it sits a little lower, but it's hard. So he also cut the floor of the car out, moved it up 6 inches to lower the car, put a flat bottom in it. My favorite Smokey Unick story is that they have limits on the amount of fuel you can carry. They do this in all motorsport events, right? So he ran like 20 miles of hard fuel line through the car so it could carry an extra 20 gallons. And still, when they inspected it, it had the same size gas tank as all the rest of them. So
some of the rally people learned from him and put fuel in the roll cages, right?
Yeah, I've heard stories about putting fuel in roll cages, saving weight by not using the metal they should be using, the steel they should be on the roll cages. Right.
Using tinfoil instead of chrome moly as an example. To finish, we were talking about Subaru with Colin McRae. For you Subaru guys, he's the poster boy, right? Yeah. Colin McRae in the blue Subaru with the gold wheels. Get out of here.
555 car.
Yeah, there you go. See, look at that. They won in 95. And then 96, Tommy McKinnon, legendary, in the Subaru, the Mitsubishi Lancer.
And then that brought in another era, another one of those great battles, the Subaru versus Mitsubishi. McKinnon versus McRae. It was
fantastic.
Yeah, motorsports better when you have a battle.
That's right. Always. Some of the forgotten Group A cars, the Ford Cosworth. I guess if we lived in Europe, we'd be more impressed with the Escort Cosworth.
Cosy.
Yeah, we don't know much about it over here. When they call it a Cosworth, what does that mean?
Cosworth is Cosworth Engineering, which has been making great engines in the UK for many, many years, for decades. They built most famously, I think, the Ford DFV Formula One engine, which I think has still won more races than any other one.
And used in more cars and longevity. Yeah.
Plus, they tweaked it and it ran at Le Mans and it ran everything that was on the road. Ford in Europe has been doing rallies since, the 60s with the Escorts.
And, exactly, rear-wheel drive. Actually, after four-wheel drive Audi came out in rally, they were actually beaten the next year for the championship by a rear-wheel drive Cosworth driven by one of these famous knuckleheads whose name I can't think of. But so the Cosworth wasn't dead even after the four-wheel drive came out. Here's a Lancer.
And then they brought out the RS200 for Group B, which was just fortunately a really awesome car, just late to the party. It got there right at the end and there was no Group B anymore.
So some other cars that came in at the end, BMW fielded an M1. Ferrari had a 308 or a 320, probably a 308 back in that time period that they tried to run.
And you had the Porsche.
Correct, 959.
The 959 for the Group B, but it didn't get to be in Group B Rally, so they put it into the car. The Ferrari
288 GTO.
Yeah. Was developed for Group, but that was for Group B, not Group B rallying. It's for Group B circuit racing, which gets lost in Group B rallying's ginormous shadow.
Yeah, exactly. BMW actually fielded an M3 in Group A. The Nissan Skyline. What makes the Nissan Skyline, the GTR, as Americans know it, what makes that car so fantastic?
The Monster Slayer, really. That's the biggest thing. It was a souped up economy car. Well, maybe not an economy car, but, you know,
an every
man's car. Yeah. Slay Ferraris, it would slay Lamborghinis, and it then went on in touring car racing to just absolutely dominate. In fact, the reason that Australian touring car went to a format of big V8 is to basically regulate out the GTR, because it won like in 2 year span, lost one race.
What makes it so good?
Great straight six engine turbocharge, and it made early horsepower turbocharging for passenger vehicles. Right. You could go in and buy in the showroom.
Right.
The engine allowed lots of room to play with it and add boost afterwards and make lots of power.
Was it always all wheel drive, or was it a front wheel drive or rear wheel drive only car for a while?
It was always all-wheel drive with the R32 generation. The Skylines go back before that. They were rear-wheel drive in the 80s, back into the 70s and when it started. But with the R32, and that's what everybody knows as the Skyline GTR, all-wheel drive. So it had a fantastic all-wheel drive system, and it did the same thing in circuit racing and touring car racing the Audi did with all-wheel drive in rally. It allowed it to corner faster, had more grip, drive circles around everything else, even though it wasn't the lightest thing, it wasn't the sleekest thing, but it had power and it could put it to the ground.
Kind of not the lightest or not the sleekest. It might have been the lightest, but the Lancia Delta, I just think it's an absolutely gorgeous car. I've always thought
that's an amazing car. Box flares fenders. Makes everything look better.
That's right. The M3.
Box flare Subaru, not tacked on SUV flares.
The M3 without box flares looks like a Toyota Celica GT4. But anyway, I digress. Oh, there it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Because an M3 without box flares is just an E30 series, which is
probably
the best looking.
Who would drive one of those, Linda? Who drive one of those, Linda?
I actually used to drive an R32 as well. They're so fast.
Oh.
So hot.
Did you?
Yes. And so if I ever felt the need for speed, I hopped in that car. It was amazing.
Since she's talking about cars they've had, let's boost your credibility a little bit. Tell us about your favorite car of all time that we're going to get for you here pretty soon.
Well, I am looking to regain my 2008 M5.
Oh.
It was sweet.
That amazing V10.
Baby car. Oh, loved it. Yes, yes. It was a gas guzzler, but it drove itself. In the M mode, not in the M mode. It doesn't matter. It was great.
I'm riding with you.
I took care of that car. I had several GoPros inside that car. It was amazing. Yeah.
She had the SMG version because, like she says, it was my daily driver and I have work to do. But, you know, nobody can argue with that version of the M5. Just fantastic.
I never considered myself a driving enthusiast until I drove an M3 that a friend of mine owned. And I was like, hey, I actually like cars.
That'll do it for you.
Yeah. So since 1987, rally winners include, 87, 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, all Lancia.
And that was a car that when they entered it in rally was based on probably an 8-year-old chassis.
Right.
And they just kept developing it. And
it was a front-wheel drive only car. It was a pedestrian car.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they finally added all-wheel drive to it. Well, that's what the Integrale was, is it meant that it was all-wheel drive for their little Delta.
And they pushed quite a bit of boost through that time four cylinder also.
What, 93, they were making 215 horsepower from 2-liter turbocharged engine, which was a healthy amount then.
Yeah.
And that was before people started playing with them again.
Right. In 90, but we've talked about this before, the Toro area Formula One, when Renault came in, I'm going to guess 83, 2-liter four cylinder in Formula One.
1.5 liter.
1.5 liter. 1,000 horsepower at the end of development cycle of that motor.
And
qualifying
trim. But
a turbo
trim,
as big as this room. So it had no subtlety at all. It was a non-op switch.
Yeah. It was nothing, nothing, nothing. Bam.
Bam.
Engine blows up.
Yeah.
And qualifying trim at the end of the turbo era, they were running where they only had to do like 3 laps before the engine blew up and could rebuild it. We're getting 1,500 horsepower out of a 1.5 liter turbocharged engine.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. The stresses are amazing.
Sometimes those 3 laps would be a pipe dream.
Right. The development of the Audi specifically in rally racing, it started off as a 250 horsepower car. And by the end of its cycle, it's a 500 horsepower car.
Yeah, and they were making even more than that when they were putting it on, when they tuned it up to go up to Pikes Peak.
Right.
I'd heard stories of over close to 700 horsepower, but because of Audi's unique engine layout, it just went straight on into the corners. It would not turn at all. It had so much power and understeer.
Vicious. 93, 94, we're back to the Toyota Celica. As late as that, they were still winning World Rally Championships.
And still fantastic looking.
Still fantastic looking, says Clint. 95, 96, 97 was Subaru, 98 Mitsubishi, and then Toyota again in 99. This time's in a Corolla. I don't remember that car.
One, it just kind of is something vague and in the background.
Mitsubishi totally blew an opportunity. They were neck and neck with Subaru, and like Josh said, Subaru capitalized on that, and it was power of the people, you can buy this car. And Mitsubishi didn't even bring the Evo here for years, if not decades, right?
It took a long time for Subaru to finally decide to bring the WRX here, and then they finally brought it. 2002, I think, was the first year for the WRX, and it was a couple more years before Mitsubishi's like, oh, that thing really is selling. Maybe we should hurry up and get the Evo over here with the Evo 7 or 8 was the first one in the U.S. By the time the Evo made it to the U.S. for sale, they were past their peak in rally.
Yeah, and rally wasn't as huge either.
That was fun. Thank you guys for coming. Josh, Clint.
Yeah. What an honor to be here today.
Yeah, this has been fun.
You.
David, thank you for joining us on KPPF Radio, Cars and Crafts, 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM.
The power of people.
Every week, we'll chat with an ambitious achiever
or two
in the local world of cars and handcrafted adult beverages here on Cars and Crafts with your hosts, Linda
and David
on KPPF, the power
of people.
Welcome back, Cars and Crafts. We have Josh and Clint, Tracy, myself, and David.
That's Linda, Cars and Crafts. We're back. We're going to talk about electric vehicles. Interestingly, they're very topical today, but they were also very topical 120 years ago. Linda has a story about electric vehicles. Let's start there.
That has nothing to do with history, though. That's not a very good segue. I'll tell my story. It's okay, David. I still love you.
We don't have to do things chronologically.
It's your show.
It's our show.
So,
it's your show.
It was probably 2015, 16-ish. I don't know what year it was. I was working in the Comic Con industry. Husband and I were looking at getting a new vehicle. I was getting rid of my F535 at the time. It was really giving me some hassle and I was using a lot of fuel. So I thought, I'll go electric. We test drove some Teslas. We test drove a Leaf. We test drove some stuff, but I still love my BMW. So we went over there and test drove the i3. We looked at a couple other ones and it wasn't really making me excited. However, I still needed to save gas. So I thought, let's try electric. Jumped in the car with the sales guy. He was super excited. He was super excited to have me. He's like, okay, I'm going to teach teach you how to drive the car, blah, blah. I'm like, dude, I just drove a couple Teslas. You don't really need to tell me anything. He's like, no, it does this, it does this. I'm like, okay, whatever makes you happy, dude. So we're tooling around. We leave the parking lot, go over to the interstate. We're on the getting on the on-ramp, and I'm ready for the car to take off. I've already floored it, already. And we're cruising up on to get on the interstate. And now the sales guy says, okay, floor it. Like, I'm sorry, I already did. So, I mean,
and nothing?
And no, I was not impressed. I mean, the one that we got, it was a burnt sienna orange. It was very boxy. It was cute. I mean, it's got the bamboo or eucalyptus wood interior. It was carbon fiber. I mean, it was really cool from that perspective, but I'd already been tainted by the Tesla, so it wasn't very exciting. So we get back to the lot. This was a Friday. And I said, dude, the numbers have to make sense. I'm trying to save money on gas. I totally get it. I understand. Husband's got one. He's got the Tesla, but whatever. So he's like, well, I'll run the numbers, see if we can make it work. I'm like, that's great. So we're getting ready to leave. And he's like, well, don't you want to keep it over the weekend? I'm like, no, I won my five. Give it back to me. So I spent my last weekend with my white 535. I think it was an XI. I don't know.
All wheel drive.
Said goodbye on Monday. Took the i3. But the cool thing was that I negotiated into the deal at that time. Galaxy Fest was coming out. Talked to EAS, Sam and Tim over there.
We like EAS.
We love EAS. I said, can you guys wrap this ugly thing? Make it look really cool. I'll buy it from them. You can be a sponsor for me. I'll put BMW and EAS on my car inside of the wrap for that. So I got a really cool discount from them. I still took the car. We only did a lease. I didn't buy it, but we drove it around and it was the sweetest
Galaxy
car.
Quest wrap?
Galaxy Fest. Galaxy like Fest. Festival, right?
Yeah.
So I had superheroes on one side. I had Miku Hatsune on the other side. I had Smeagol. I had Star Trek Enterprise on the top of it. I had TIE Fighters. I had Death Star on the front side. It was really sweet. So we wrapped it so that
you could see. Nicest I3 in the country.
Yeah, it was sweet. You couldn't see the lines. You couldn't see how ugly and boxy. It was a full wrap. So you didn't see any orange. You didn't see any of that stuff. It was pretty cool.
That's awesome. Tell us more about the driving experience of the i3. Did it ever get any better? Did you ever find a mode where it would actually drive like a car?
I ran out of range because I didn't know what I was doing. There's a button that says eco, right? I didn't know this. I just had it in the fastest mode that I could have because that's what I want. I just want to go fast. So I drove it all day. The range is like 78 miles or something. It's an in-city car. It was fast. It corners. It does some fun stuff. But it was just, I couldn't drive it long enough, fast enough to really enjoy it. So my first night with the car, I sat in the parking lot of the Space Foundation, plugging in. I hope they're not listening because I plugged into their outdoor outlet to get enough juice to drive back.
And how long did it take to charge up?
It took me 2 hours to get enough juice from zero to be able to drive 5 miles home.
And this was 5 years ago?
It's been, that sounds about right.
Okay. So unfortunately, the cars have improved a little. I'm not impressed. I don't think they've improved that much since your story.
I mean, it's great for in-city driving. It's great for if you don't have to go
over. If you live in Tokyo,
it's great if you need to go super fast and you just want to just tool around town and go get your groceries and your kids and your dog.
You may not know this, but we leased a Leaf actually for 3 years. And that's exactly what I would tell people.
Can you see my face?
Well, we didn't quite vomit in it, but we did say to people, it's a perfect second car because we lived on the southern part of the Springs and we had friends up in Monument and that was the extent of its range. That's from our house to Monument back was all the Leaf could do, especially where our speeds in Colorado on the highway are 75, 80. So that just nukes the battery so fast on those kind of first gen efforts.
Right. But you know, the city has put out more charging stations and superchargers and things like that. So I've learned where to park, where to plug it in, where to spend my time, where to grab the coffee so that the car could recharge, that kind of thing. So
it still takes a long time to recharge any significant amount.
It does.
Yeah, that's a lot of coffee. Even a supercharger in a Model 3, I think it takes at least an hour and 45 minutes or something to get a reasonable charge.
It depends. I mean, most Tesla drivers won't drain it all the way. They'll take it about half, fill it up, take it home, trickle charger, and then drain it, you know, maybe once a month and then supercharge it back up again. It's not bad. It's
supercharger is 15 for, and it doesn't
15
give you
minutes?
A full, yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't take that long.
Because I want to say they're running 440 when you do the supercharger.
What do you mean running
voltage,
440?
Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Voltage. So yeah, that's what kills you on the electric cars is the trickle charger is only 110.
Right. That takes forever.
Yeah. My friends just bought, not to get too tangential, but they just bought the Jeep plug-in, which is brand new for this year.
Right. I saw that.
Yeah. It's got about 23 mile range, I think, rated. And so with the 110, that's not a big deal because you're going to get that overnight very easily. The Leaf or the i3, it's all battery.
Right.
And if you're doing just a 110, it's like a full 12, 14 hour charge.
It takes
but
a
once
while.
You do the 220, even the Leaf, this was back, that thing was developed, you know, late aughts, because you could get it on the coast 11 or 12. We got, I think, a 12 here in the Springs. That was the first model. Yeah, that was the first model year that was available here. And if you had a 220, then it dropped to about 7 hours. So, and that's for a full charge. So it's all about the voltage. And I do believe the superchargers are a 440.
They're super fast.
Maybe
they
300
are. They're
something.
Super fast.
Maybe it's Porsche that does the 440.
Porsche's a, what is it, 880 or
really?
Something
wow.
bonkers.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't take long if you find the
Porsche
record.
Ramped up the voltage and dropped the amperage to do their battery architecture.
So you can recharge your entire battery pack in 15 minutes, you're telling me, in the current with the current technology.
With a three now, I think
but it's not
about
a full
80%.
Charge.
It's not a
it's from
80%?
Like 20 to 80
oh, okay.
or something. Yep. It's like if you went from fully depleted to 100% full, you're back looking at like
full. It's like
yeah, why would you
lithium ion? Right. It's because lithium ion is designed to hang out in that middle ground. And so the supercharger will go, like you said, 20 to 80 or 10 to 80, whatever it is, in the 15 minutes. And then just like your phone, it slows down
right.
and it goes from the 80 to the 100. And that's
where it
like Linda said, where it's going to be the overnight, you're trickling,
right.
you top it off. But
well,
yeah,
that
those
makes
superchargers,
sense.
Yeah. I mean, 15 minutes, that's the Italian style.
Not bad.
You get a cup of coffee, you relax, stretch your legs, and you've got a lot of juice back.
Yeah. We took the Model 3 from our house here. We went to go visit the grandparents in Kansas. We routed everything. We charged along the way. And I think the longest we spent was 20 minutes on our charger. Honestly, it wasn't awful.
I did not know that. That's news to me, because the everything I read tells me things that are slightly different. So it's good to have firsthand information. Speaking of lithium ion, the biggest limiting factor in electric vehicles is the batteries. When you compare it to the technology that we have in solar power and wind power and these other things, we are so far behind on battery technology. Now, it sounds to me that I'm slightly ill-informed, because there's been greater advancements than I'm aware of, I guess, recently. What I wanted to say is that electric cars were very popular 120 years ago. Matter of fact, according to this article, 38% of all the cars that were on the road in 1900 were electric. So what led to the popularity of electric cars 120 years ago, and why did it go away?
People liked electric cars then because they were easier, and it wasn't like now where you have a gas station. It wasn't competing with gas cars that you could fill up.
You were competing with the horse and buggy.
Yeah. So you could, I think most people that could afford to have a car then actually had electricity at their house. So you could.
Yeah, which is still relatively new.
You had service shops that had offered electric charging. You could charge it up, and they were quiet. They weren't automobiles at that time. They were loud. They were smelly. You had to hand crank them.
Slow
and break your wrist off when you try to crank
Very
the starter.
Awkward.
And so there are
some of the other problems that the horse and buggy had back in that time period is that the streets were full of horse crap, and this became a real problem. And they also marketed the electric vehicles toward women, because this time period that women were enjoying to drive. And you talk about hand cranking and all the problems with a petrol powered early vehicle. The electric car solved a lot of those problems. The downside of that marketing was the perception was it was an effeminate vehicle if you drove an electric vehicle, because so many women had it. So Thomas Edison, who was the father of electricity in America, allegedly, back in those days, actually started his own electric vehicle company. And guess who his number two was? Henry Ford. Huh. And Henry Ford went on to be Henry Ford. And Henry Ford was going to build electric vehicles using Edison batteries. They had obviously a great relationship. He was solely going to use Edison batteries. So he made this huge investment, $13.5 million in 1910.
That's a lot.
I don't know what the equivalent is today, but it's a lot of money. And Edison batteries were garbage.
Oh,
they wouldn't even get the car to move. His engineers were having a fit. They were tearing his hair out. They were trying to convince him to go to some other battery supplier. He wouldn't do it. So he wound up shutting down the whole electric vehicle operation and going solely to petrol cars. Single-handedly, those two names killed electric vehicles in America. And the other part of it was, as we can all imagine, the crude oil that they discovered in Texas and how that lobby took over and just dominated
the
economy. The
other big thing is the electric starter. So you could just turn a switch, a key.
Right. Not if you got to crank it in the snow and the mud and break
your
wrist.
So you didn't have to do it. And that, and then Ford making the Model T in an affordable vehicle. Just
an amazing vehicle.
Yeah.
The number of manufacturers that there were in 1900 that made electric vehicles is absolutely astonishing. This is just a short list. I think there was, 38% of the cars on the road were electric. That tells you how many options that were available.
That's a lot more than right now.
Right.
So let's
up to 2%. I think I just read the other day. I mean, it's a tiny amount, which is going to make all these new standards interesting, because we're all supposed to be switching, you know, as a country and as a world and so on. And there is so much existing inventory on the road. I don't know how they're ever going to get people to part with them without massive incentivization.
And let's talk about what the advantages is to electric vehicles. I mean, what are we really accomplishing here? When electric vehicles first came out, they talked about we weren't reducing pollution. We were just exporting pollution outside the city. Electricity has to be made somewhere. And when electric vehicles first came out, it was primarily coal generating plants. So instead of creating pollution from cars, carbon dioxide and all that in the inner city, if it was all electric cars in the inner city, they have to get electricity from somewhere. And so they move the coal plants outside of town. So it's the poor people that suffer versus the people that live in the city. So you're exporting the pollution somewhere else, but not necessarily reducing overall pollution. That's one argument. Things may change. Things may have changed. But I think the biggest thing is this lithium production, which is the core of batteries for cell phones, laptops, and electric vehicles. And what have you heard about lithium production?
Well, it's going to run out eventually. I mean,
it is a natural element. You have to mine it, correct?
Mm-hmm. And they say as soon as 2040, it could run out. So what are they going to do after that?
And the costs of lithium mining. Do you guys know anything about it? Have an opinion?
I've watched some videos comparing the carbon footprint of the mining, and there is a cost to it. There, not so much the human cost, but the carbon footprint, if you're just speaking in a purely carbon sense. And a video compared a hybrid RAV to the Model Y, the little bubbly Jetson Tesla, you know, it pretends to be an SUV. And it only took a year and a half for the Model Y to offset the carbon emissions in the hybrid. And from then on, you're actually still netting better. So as long as you keep your Tesla for more than a year and a half, it sounds like you do offset the emissions.
But that's your personal carbon footprint, as you put it. That's what happens in your household. That really doesn't sound like to me that takes into account the costs to mine the lithium to make that car actually exist. Because I think if you include that and all the costs associated with that, it changes the argument. It makes it quite a bit different.
You're still cutting way down on your total energy usage. An electric car, including, you know, from the cradle to grave argument versus a petrol.
And he did.
Fair enough.
He did. Yeah. And he's an engineer. So he did incorporate, basically took his power coming from the grid as the mix of where the grid is right now. So, you know, X amount of coal, X amount of wind, X amount of solar. So as the grid becomes greener, then that drops off even quicker.
I think where I'm going with this, and I hear what you're saying, and it makes perfect sense to me, is the cost of mining lithium. What have you learned about that, Tracy, if anything, in the last?
That it comes from Chile.
Primarily, Chile is the number one producer.
In Australia.
Right. Big producer. China. The United States is a relatively small producer. So they actually
have to assume that somewhere in Russia, there's a huge deposit of lithium.
Exactly.
That's found yet, which.
So yeah, Siberia. Nobody knows what's in Siberia. They actually leach it from the ground. It's a multi-stage process. And it's something like, I had a number in front of me a minute ago, but it's something like 30,000 gallons of water for every one ton. So when it goes to places like Chile and whatever, it's actually stealing water from the population, from the farmers, from the aquifer. I mean, it's hugely violating in that aspect. And also a lot of these poor countries that are mining lithium and what's the primary chemical in cell phone batteries? Cobalt.
Okay.
Yeah. They use child labor and actually slave labor as well.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. And so they're exposing, you know, kids and, you know, again, the poor underprivileged population to, you know, horrible work conditions, toxic environments, et cetera, eroding their lifespan. So I'm not sure when we look at like your measurement, like you were talking about the engineer measured what was coming off the grid, if all of these costs are being taken into effect. Now, what Tracy says is going to be depleted in 2040. So in a short period of time, all this stuff may not matter anyway, but what's going to replace it? Tracy, you had more?
Yeah. Some more drawbacks and disadvantages of the lithium ion battery is it lasts 2 to 3 years after manufacture, and it's also sensitive to high temperatures. And if the battery completely discharges, it is no longer be charged again, which is relatively expensive.
So if you totally deplete a lithium ion, then you can't recharge it. It's hard to totally deplete one though, isn't it? They're talking about 0, 0, 0, like almost Kelvin.
And that's where the biggest advancement too comes from is the computer controls. So the way the battery's energy flow is controlled, that won't let it completely.
I'm going to say it probably will never happen.
You'll get like 0% left on your little readout on your car, but there's still charge in the battery.
There's still 20 miles of gas left. You can make it home, right?
It's kind
of
like with a diesel engine, you can't let it run out because then you get air in it. So it keeps it from ever completely running out.
So let's talk about the excitement, the attractiveness of electric vehicles versus what we're used to.
Speed.
Well, talk about
instant.
The torque.
Yeah.
Gas fill. It's amazing. Yep. It's fast. It's super fast. It's immediate fast. And for me, it was all electric. So I had no gas bill, no fuel bill. I didn't have to worry about it. It's funny because the husband went and drove my car the other day and he had to put gas. And he's like, I forgot how to put gas in the car. I was laughing. It was so funny. But, you know, saving money on that is huge. I heard that there's still tax credits or incentives out there to be able to buy.
From most manufacturers. Yep.
So who knows how long that's going to last, but my biggest love is being able to go.
And maintenance cost or
your biggest love is what?
Going quickly.
Right. I was going to say, what about the visceralness?
Oh yeah, you can't
beat her V10 M5 versus a Leaf. You know, even if it does have more torque at 0 RPM than the M5.
Well, and that's the thing with electric though, is you get the same sensation in a pretty much off the shelf Model 3 up until about 50. It's right. When you start to go beyond that, then the gas engine starts to prove its value again. But yeah, the initial acceleration, my friend had what's called a standard Range Plus 3 rear wheel drive in California, the perfect state for it. I mean, that thing was an absolute blast off of every stop sign because the torque is just there and it's ready to go. And that's with eco tires. I can't even imagine if you put track tires on one of those, you know, the kind of acceleration you get.
You start ripping up components just like a Hellcat if you put stinky tires on it, right? You're going to blow the axle out of it. Go ahead.
Then as a tool, mobility tool, I think they actually make a lot of sense. I'm not excited about them, but they make a lot of sense. It's
logical, not visceral.
Yes. You can charge them at home. Their maintenance costs are real low. You don't have to take it in for an oil
change. Fewer moving parts.
Yeah. So it's just you're spending a lot of time driving. You don't have to do that much to deal with it.
Right. Electric motors are inherently more simple, right?
Yeah. It's a one spinning rotor. It's it.
Yeah.
I have a question. I'm curious, is there a charge when you charge up your vehicle?
It depends. So there are companies that have installed charging stations at their corporate building or facility or whatever. So if you're an employee, then there's no charge to that. They give it to their employee. You can hit other charging stations. So if I wanted to put a charging station in my home, I could charge people to come to my garage in my backyard to use a charging station. I could make some money. They would pay some money. It depends on convenience and who knows how to drive an electric vehicle when I first get one, right? So, and then there's free ones. Like I could name off a dozen of them here in town where I can go plug in a car. I can go have a coffee, do whatever I want to do, and just let it sit there and probably upset some other folks if they want to charge in their car. So there's all
options. How can they be free? Because there's a capital expense to install the station. There's obviously an expense to provide the electricity. Who's sponsoring this?
The venue.
Yep, the venue.
Exactly. The venue. The perfect example, I'll name drop them. Mm-hmm. The Antlers downtown. The Antlers Hilton Hotel downtown or whatever they are. They have several charging stations inside their parking garage. Two of them are specific to EV and one of them is specific to Tesla. So you can take your car in there. You can plug it in. Typically, it's for their guests. But for those of us who have lived here for many, many years, we know where we can go. We can plug in the car and just let it sit there.
What is the cost if you were to pay for it off your own grid? What is the cost to fully charge a Model 3 today?
Depending on your grid, you know, because obviously electric is different in different places. But I want to say it's something absurdly small, like $3 to $5 here in town.
Yeah, I was thinking $5.
And you're typically
in Texas should be $120.
right, exactly. The advantage too is because it's such a slow charge, you're almost always off peak charging because your rates are adjusted. You know, you're not in that 5 to 9 where everybody's streaming Netflix and the AC's going and blah blah blah. And on the newer cars, you can time when it charges via app, so you're literally plugging in from 11 to 6 where the electricity is the cheapest.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Let's go back to talking about the visceral, especially you, Linda, queen of the M5, and also had an i3. Let's talk about the visceral part of it. Is it worth it? I enjoy burning dinosaurs. I'm older. I'm old school. That works for me. It does it for me. For me, it's the whole point of having a car. But tell me.
Well, that's why I have two. Right. We have a Tesla and we have two BMWs. So I love the feel of the Tesla. When, like you're saying, it's a great tool. You can get out there, do what you need to do, get to your place, not have to worry about anything. It drives easy, smooth. But if I want to get out there and really have a good time, I'm going to jump in my M5. I'm going to fire that bad boy up and I'm going to fly down the interstate and I'm going to hear it, feel it, smell it. That's what I love about a car. I love to be able to get in it and just be one with that car.
Plus you could drive to Breckenridge and back on a Sunday morning and not have to think about watching your electricity gauge and where do I have to stop. Now, I thought you'd have to stop for an hour and a half to get a boost to get back home, but it was only 15 minutes. Who cares? Yeah. So
and it depends on, frankly, it depends on which battery you buy too. Do you have a three
or the three.
Y?
Yeah, we have the three.
Good, because I talked smack about the Y. So good. But yeah, I was just looking at them this morning. Their sort of mid-range battery has a 320-mile range. Yeah. That's Brecken back good. With room to spare. Batteries are still heavily impacted by the cold.
Yeah, the weather does make an impact.
Or really hot days, but here it's winter weather.
It erodes the efficiency of the battery. You know, it doesn't charge as well. It doesn't discharge as well.
Yeah. I feel like winter weather driving, so, you know, under 35 degrees drops it by something like at least 35%.
Wow. Right. Significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't make it all the way to Breck.
Even in winter driving too, I had a really hard time driving the i3 because when you come up off the accelerator, you have that
regenerative braking.
Right. So, I couldn't drive, I didn't learn how to drive that car in the winter because I was always sliding and I didn't want to on a leased car slide the wheels into a curb, right? I don't want to do that. So for me, it was difficult to drive an electric during the winter, especially in Colorado. So then we had the R30.
Does it have a different mode? Because it had an eco mode and a power mode. Does it have a...
There's no winter mode. Yeah.
Yeah. We struggled with that with the Leaf too, because there was so much torque that it wanted to put it down so quickly, it would actually spin the tires, out.
Which is the last thing you want to do.
Yep.
Yeah. Right. 10 second gear on an EV.
That's right. Which you should be able to. It should have a snow mode. It should
there
start.
Used to be. There used to be a snow mode. We were last year in the winter, we had the three out. It started to snow. I think we were in Peyton or something. We had to come home. It was snowing really light. The closer we got to home, the worse it was. It was like, look up the winter mode, the winter driving on this thing. And I spent the entire time from there getting home looking up, and we found out that it was disabled. They didn't have it anymore. Yeah.
That's
so
the take into to over the air updates.
Yeah.
And this is the other part of it that makes me dizzy. But again, I've already admitted that I'm old and I'm old school. But the car I drive, it's got a big V8, it's got a clutch, it's got a manual. There's very little on it that can go wrong. And it gives me, you know, all the thrill that I need. I don't need a television in the car. I don't need traction control. I don't need, you know, a lot of this stuff. And
you need brakes.
Brakes eventually. But when you talk about electric vehicles, it is a bigger iPad. You know, it's a complicated, multifunctioning, primarily, well, 100% electronic and electric interfaces and switches and relays. And not only does it leave me cold, but it's also...
It's more than you want to try to figure out.
It's a different generation for you, David.
It is. It is a different generation for me. Yeah.
Now, do you mm-hmm. agree that when you put the 3 into the appropriate mode, the acceleration mm-hmm. up until 60-ish is just as fun? Or do you prefer...
Okay. No, it's great.
And I think that's what David needs to...
But you don't get the noise. You don't get the noise, the rumble in your butt. You don't get all that.
You could artificially...
That's another thing.
I know.
That's another show about artificially putting exhaust notes into the stereo system. I hate that.
Worst thing ever. But yeah. I do think it would serve you well to actually play around with one, because
it would take more than play. It would take at least a month or so. It took me a little bit to get used to mine. It would take a month or so of you driving it every day, everywhere you go, being forced to drive it. You would learn to appreciate it. Maybe not love it, but you would learn to appreciate it.
Well, I get that. And it makes perfect sense to me that, you know, I have to be flexible and change with the times. And there's huge advantages to it. Tracy and I were talking about her son races karts, and I asked her about if they went to Overdrive, which is a fully electric kart racing system here north of town. I've done that. I've done many, many, many laps at Overdrive in a fully electric kart, and I used to race shifter karts, you know, gas powered, four wheel disc brake, motorcycle sequential transmission. But I didn't miss any of that in the electric kart because of what you're talking about. The torque was there, the weight's all on the bottom, it handled terrifically. The other part of it is too, you can run them indoors.
Yeah, because that's what I was saying is if you could, and I know it's hard to, but if you could try it and just take the noise out of it, the drama out of it, could you eventually come to love it? Because it's still speed.
Yeah.
And that's why I like them, and that's why I thought about leasing one this morning. Because you get the speed, and there is some just inherent perks, like you said, the lower center of gravity, et cetera. But I get it.
What's the rest of your internal conversation, which I know is broad and deep and multifaceted?
Yeah, we don't have time.
Well, give
that's
us
a
the,
whole new segment.
Give us the Clint Cliff Notes version of your conversation with yourself about leasing an electric vehicle.
I think the only drawback for me is no clutch. You know, the clutch and the manually shifting of a car, that is something I still adore, and why I did order another WRX, because I miss shifting my car. But I think the electric makes almost everything else obsolete. You know, you don't need the roar of a V8 or a V10 or a V12. If batteries catch up and they can do everything else, you've got kind of no downside. And again, I think...
Except for the poor kids that are leaching lithium out of the ground in Chile.
Right.
Of course. Yes,
diamond batteries are a drawback.
Yeah. Well, you know, not that petrochemicals doesn't have some slave labor.
But it's not like there's river deltas in Nigeria that are filled with oil spill and
the Louisiana coastline covered in oil.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
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 You know, maybe Cars and Crafts could get an electric vehicle demo day and have you guys come out. We could play and then compare it to Porsche or BMW or the WRX. And
well, I would like to drive the Porsche electric.
Oh, yeah.
The Taycan looks fantastic. And I imagine because it's a Porsche.
Right.
I mean, nothing feels like a Porsche. Here's a Porsche story. This is real quick. 5-10 years ago, I went to buy a new pair of glasses. And my mother, I spent time with my mother at the time. She's still alive. So she went with. So we went glass frame shopping. And I found this place north end of town, higher end, fancy place. And I was just, you know, I wasn't paying attention to price. And I tried on a pair of Porsche branded eyeglass frames. I swear to God, a blind taste test, I could absolutely tell the difference.
No,
there was no question that I was in. It was in the presence of significant German engineering. It was ridiculous.
Okay, David.
What do you drive? I'm sure it's not electric.
So yes, I drive a 2004 GMC Yukon. I get 13 miles per gallon.
Ouch.
So this is why I have so many questions about this electrical vehicle, because I also am a single mother and I want to save money. $75 every week. It sucks.
Yeah. Well, these are your guys also, by the way, Clint and Josh, that's what they do. They're independent auto brokers. So if you ever need help sourcing a proper vehicle, these are the guys to come to. We'll talk more about that in the future.
Thank Fantastic plug, by the way.
Yeah.
For free. Have you test driven electric vehicles?
I have not. I've only researched.
And especially then... coming out of a Yukon, you're going to enjoy it so much more. That thing is a beast.
I worry in the snow. That's my thing.
Snow tires.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
There's, you know, 3 days a year in Colorado. People talk about the snow and the outdoor all-wheel drive and that, but it's 3 days a year. And if it comes up your bumper, stay
home. Wisconsin, so there really is no snow here in Colorado. So you're right.
Snow tires means all-wheel drive any day of the week.
And if it snows up the bumper, stay home. I said that a minute ago. I'm not sure when you heard me, but
which I don't mind either. See, that's all right.
Yeah. Well, that's been a great show about electric vehicles. I think we covered 120 years worth of information there. I thought it was, I learned a lot. It may or may not have changed my attitude about it. I'm going to say it has changed my attitude about it.
A little bit.
I still don't like the idea of the poor kids in Chile, but there's plenty of those stories around the world. And if we start focusing on that, we're all going to sleep in a gas chamber. I don't know.
Frankly, and we'll have to revisit. Everybody is getting to market now with their competitors.
Right.
I mean, Tesla did shake everything up. It's taken a long time for automakers to turn that huge barge. But over the next 3 to 4 years, I mean, you have an electric Hummer coming. Yeah. We'll talk about the opposite end of the spectrum. So it's.
I saw the hybrid Jeep the other day, too. It's super sexy. And to see a hybrid Jeep with still the same power, it was amazing.
Yeah,
I didn't get to take the drive, but it was super sweet.
And if you just look at the number of new companies that have emerged in China alone, NIO, there's another one with an unpronounceable name, Rivian, that's not a Chinese company, but the number of new manufacturers that are out creating vehicles a la following the Tesla model. I'm still stunned that Tesla was able to put a car together on their own, starting with nothing in a relatively short period of time. And for all intents and purposes, it actually drives like a car.
Yeah.
Which stuns
with nothing.
Me.
They started with a Lotus.
Well, there you go. Well, thanks, guys, for joining us. And Lady.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Great
You're listening to Cars and Crafts on KPBF Radio, 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM.
The power
of people. Had a great time with you guys today. Looking forward to the next show. What are we going to talk about next time, David?
We'll be out at car shows and your favorite local brewery, meeting and talking with personalities and entrepreneurs building cars.
And filling kegs.
Every week here on Cars and Crafts.
Stay tuned. We'll see you next time on Cars and Crafts, 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM.
The power
of people.